I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. After the police acquittal in the Rodney King trial almost 30 years ago and the demonstrations in Ferguson and Baltimore 5 years ago, police misconduct and violence is once again under scrutiny following the high-profile deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others. For years, there has been talk of reforms to policing. In fact, in 2015, President Obama convened a task force of police professionals, attorneys, and community activists to come up with numerous recommendations for what it called 21st century policing, many of which have languished. Racial bias, violent tactics, and militarization still persist, according to the authors of the report. Today on Radio Times, why do these problems persist and what can be done to bring about real reform? And we have three guests who have joined us. Sonia Pruitt is a former captain of the Montgomery County Police Department in Maryland, and she's chairwoman of the National Black Police Association. Sonia Pruitt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Lawrence Ralph. He's a professor of anthropology at Princeton University and director of the school's Center on Transnational Policing. Lawrence Ralph, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype is Robert Kane. He's department head and professor of criminology and justice studies at Drexel University. Robert Kane, rounding out our trio of guests, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. And we will get him up and running. We do have him by Skype, but I am looking at our engineer and producer, and we'll try to figure that out. Lawrence Ralph, let me start with you, but Sonia Pruitt, I want to hear from you as well. We have been here before, Lawrence Ralph, in terms of calls for police reform. I mentioned a couple of moments in our history in my introduction. Do you think this time it's going to be different?
I think it has the potential to be different. We're seeing arguably one of the most expansive protests in response to police violence in American history right now. It's more diverse than ever before. And we're seeing different demands, like the demand to defund or reprioritize resources to police departments. So I think that there is some acknowledgement that what has happened in the past has not provided fruit, and also that there's been resistance from police unions, and people are looking for new ways to address these problems.
And to you, Sonia Pruitt, how do you see it? Are we at a different juncture, a different moment in our history here?
I think that we absolutely are. And, you know, it's been past time. It's like 400 years past time. But here we are now, and in my opinion, we don't have room to do what I call the moonwalk and go back to what was our normal, which is to have an incident occur. We have some outrage and some uprising. And then a couple of months later, you know, we've moved on to something else. I am happy to see that the people that we serve, because, you know, the police are there to serve the people. We are there because of the people. I am happy to see that people are in a place where, at least seemingly, they do not want to backpedal, and that they are going to stay in it for the long run.
Lawrence, let me turn back to you. And you talked about defunding the police, and that's a phrase we've gotten very used to, but I do think it has various interpretations. When you say that, how do you mean it?
I mean to think about how we spend taxpayer money. I think that when people say defunding the police, the knee-jerk reaction is to say that, oh, you're saying that you're stripping away all the resources from the police. But I think that even people who are just want reform as opposed to radical structural change know that, you know, the police aren't necessarily equipped to handle all the public safety problems they face on an everyday basis. They face alcoholism and drug abuse, and they face mental health crises. And the question is, who are the best public servants equipped to handle those problems? And understanding that those are underlying problems that we need to be preventative in addressing rather than reactive. And the police are very good at reacting to problems, but we need to figure out who are society is best served by.
And I do want to pick up on that. I do believe we have Robert Kane in on the conversation again, joining us by Skype. And Robert Kane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And I'll just sort of start over very briefly, if you don't mind. Just are we at a turning point, do you think, in this country when it comes to police reform?
I sure hope we are. I thought that 2015 was going to be that watershed moment. And it seems that to a great extent, it's just been business as usual. And so 5 years later, we see this other enormous event, you know, happen, really a series of events. So and this one seems to resonate nationally much more than Ferguson did. So I'm hoping we're at a moment, a crossroads, and a moment where we can actually make a decision about how we want to reimagine our police might look going forward.
I wonder, Robert Kane, just picking up on that, and I watched the video of George Floyd, frankly, dying under the knee of a police officer. Do you think the fact that we got to watch this moment in a person's life sort of has changed the conversation?
I think so. What we saw was basically a horrific murder, as far as I'm concerned. And it seems, and this was a situation where other officers stood by and allowed it to happen, despite the fact that from at least the video and the audio, you know, we could hear bystanders asking the police officers to do something, and they just stood there frozen. So, yeah, I think that this probably does essentially up the intensity of the situation. It seems to me the first time we really saw something like this on tape was the Rodney King beating in 91. And, you know, we've seen subsequent since then. But this one seems to have really just shocked the conscience.
Sonia, let me go back to you as a police officer, former captain of the Montgomery County Police Department. What we observed in the death of George Floyd, is that allowed by police departments in this country?
I certainly hope murder is not allowed in any police department. But I like what Mr. Kane just said about a turning point in policing, such as the Rodney King incident. I mean, you would have thought right there that we would have opened our eyes and said, okay, this is something that the Black community at least has been talking about for a while. And now we can see it with our own eyes. But still, this country held firm to the issue in policing, which is the policing culture, which is based on racism to a huge extent, dating back to slave patrols. Well, I won't give us a history lesson now, but here we are again. We had the Michael Brown incident. That was another turning point. That's when body-worn cameras became a really big issue. And we had 21st century policing through President Obama. So here we are again. And as I said before, this is a turning point, but what are we going to do with it? I personally, as a former police officer now and still working in the realm of social justice, mm-hmm. I don't see that we should be conceding any ground here.
I do want to look forward and I do want to talk about reforms. But Lawrence Ralph, if I can go back to you, what has been the resistance? I mean, I think we have to understand the resistance in order to figure out what these reforms would look like. But what has been the pushback?
Well, I think that we have a big pushback from police unions. I think that after the Obama's presidential reform, I think people underestimated the impact of police unions. And even when a police chief, for instance, wants to fire someone, oftentimes they can't do that successfully. And oftentimes the person gets rehired. And so I think we have to think about, as Sonia said, when we think about the playbook at hand, what we've gone to is large committees, large reports, introducing technology to change the situation. But we have to address the root of it, which is systemic racism and social inequality in our society. And how do we think about addressing that in the realm of public safety?
But are you saying that the problem is really bigger than the police?
I think that the problem is bigger than the police, but the police are such an important institution in society because for many Americans, they represent the public face of the government, and they represent the public face of who they interact with on an everyday as governmental representatives. And so if that body is prone to be corrupt, if that body can't gain legitimacy and trust, that speaks to a wider presence in how people think about the government in their lives. So the police are vitally important in that regard.
Robert, let me go back to you. And we're having this conversation after a very violent weekend here in Philadelphia and in other cities as well. Numerous shootings, numerous people who died, not at the hands of the police, but at the hands of people living in these communities. Factor that into our conversation.
Well, so I would love to factor that in, but I feel like I need to kind of respond to something that Professor Ralph just said, because he's hitting something on the head that I think we all need to think about. And that is that the police are the public and the public is the police. And so on one hand, you know, police officers are raised before they're ever cops. They are raised in the same society that the rest of us are raised in. They go to our schools. They socialize with us. They see us on the sports field. So police officers come from society. So when we ask the question, is there a systemic problem in policing and does it reside squarely with the police? My answer has to be, yeah, there's a problem, but it doesn't reside squarely with the police. It's a social issue. And one of the a big problem here we see is that policing is a really closed society. Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, subculture that permeates that demands adherence to norms, that really treats other officers poorly if they step outside and share information or don't, you know, have solidarity with their peers. And it seems to me that any reform efforts have to respond to the closed society that police experience. And that means opening up the police and really sort of showing, you know, shining sunlight on policing as an institution, because that's really the best way, I think, for us to start the conversation. These other reform efforts, they're all downstream. They're, you know, telling police departments that they can't use carotid restraint holds and telling police departments they can't purchase MRAPs. That's fine, but that's so far downstream that it's not going to address the root of the problem.
Mm. Well, and I know do want to flesh that out, but if you can also just respond, and we're almost up in a break here, just the fact that it was a very violent weekend in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're living in a very uncertain time, and uncertainty is in many cases a root cause of violence and other criminal behavior. I mean, the theories of criminology that show us how uncertainty is problematic, you know, in neighborhoods and among individuals, is, you know, it's the evidence is there. So it doesn't surprise me a bit. Part of this may be that there are fewer police on the street. Part of it may be that, you know, younger kids are home a lot. And so they're trying to get out. So it really doesn't surprise me that we're starting to see violence creep up.
And that is Robert Kane. He's head of the Department of Criminology and Justice Studies at Drexel University. Lawrence Ralph is with us as well. He's a professor of anthropology at Princeton University, director of the School Center on Transnational Policing. And Sonia Pruitt is our third of three guests in this hour of the show, former captain of the Montgomery County Police Department in Maryland and chairwoman of the National Black Police Association. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about police reform. What would it look like? And again, talking with Sonia Pruitt, Robert Kane, and Lawrence Ralph. Sonia, let me go back to you. And the Washington Post had a long story either today or yesterday having to do with the experience of black police officers. And I just want to quote a couple of sentences that the authors of the story in the Washington Post write. They say, this is talking about black police officers. They sign up for a job that offers a path to a middle-class life and a chance to honor their communities by pledging to protect them. But they face questions of loyalty from neighbors who are skeptical of law enforcement. They want to be the change, then realize what they're up against, a police culture with a legacy of prejudice, protected by unions, resistant to self-examination, and primed to use force. Does that seem, based on your own experience and your work with the National Black Police Association, does that seem right on to you?
It is absolutely accurate. Our organization was actually founded based on just those things that you read to the audience. We've been fighting this battle inside policing for a really long time. It took a while for policing to even allow us to be a part of the ranks. And we still, at this juncture in 2020, don't feel completely accepted. I think it was Mr. Kane who just talked about the policing culture, which can be isolating and punishing. So imagine coming in and saying, I'm going to make a difference, I'm going to make a difference, in particular for the Black community, which is one of the most vulnerable and has this relationship, this contentious relationship with the police. And then when you get inside, you find out that is just not going to be allowed. I mean, there's story after story from Black officers that you can probably Google right about now, because now Black officers are feeling empowered to tell their stories.
Let me turn to you, Lawrence Ruff. How do you see that?
I think that's right on, and I thank Sonia for the work that she's been doing for decades. And in my own research, I speak to Black officers around police abuse and police violence, and it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you can't speak up, because if you do, then you face harsh repercussions, and it impacts your career and sometimes your safety. And on the other hand, if you play along and get along, even if you aren't directly participating, but if you just look the other way and you bury your head in the sand, you perpetuate the cycle. And we've seen this, as Robert discussed, in that precise instance when George Floyd expired, when the police officers were looking the other way. You know, another way of seeing that is they were trained and conditioned not to say anything when an incident of force occurs. And so that's precisely what they did, nothing.
Let me and get, yet, if I can jump in.
Yeah, I was going to say, go ahead, Lawrence. Robert Kane, go ahead.
Sorry. To follow up on what Lawrence just said, the thing about it is in Minneapolis, the police department passed a new use of force policy in 2016 that included a peer intervention requirement. So when Lawrence says they weren't trained, actually in Minneapolis, they were supposedly trained on this policy, and they were required to intervene. And yet the policing subculture that demands adherence to, you know, peer group norms kept them from doing a thing in violation of their own policy.
Let me get Mike from Germantown to join our conversation. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Morning. Go ahead.
I think your comment about this weekend's violence is absolutely right on spot. I mean, if you're concerned as a citizen, how about if you're the policeman who's rolling up on that scene? How about the policeman who's got about 2 nanoseconds to figure out whether that person's actions or the way they're acting is going to allow him to go home and see his family tonight? I think the operating emotion that we're talking about is fear. And now we're asking the police to, and they should be afraid. Now we're asking them to be perfect. If they make a mistake, if they misjudge, now their entire lives are gone. Their families' lives are gone. So now fear is going to be replaced by ambivalence. And if they don't respond the way they should to these kinds of situations, I think it's careful what you ask for, because I think the situation is going to get doubly bad. So I think you were right on the mark with your observations about the impact of the violence and what we're expecting out of our police.
I appreciate the call. Let me give Sonia Pruitt a chance as someone who has worked as a police officer. What do you say back to Mike?
That respectfully, I don't agree with most of what he just said. Listen, we take the job. We know what the risks are. If we're allowing our quote unquote fear, because, you know, that's questionable for me in some of these use of force cases. But if we let this fear overtake our commitment and what we swore to do, which is to protect our communities, then, OK, we don't need to be the police. I am sure that, you know, people talk about good police. I have a theory about that, too, that's going to be too long for me to go into. But if you're a good police officer, you don't have to have fear when you step into a community that you have nurtured, because that's part of our jobs, too. our job is to be the protectors and servers of the community. It's not the other way around. So, you know, I could go on and on about it, but I'm just sort of not in agreement with that.
I hear you. Robert Kane, let me talk to you a bit about, and you've written about the recruiting of police officers and what to look for. And part of your criticism is that it's just sort of a very narrow cast that we have for the kind of person that we think would be a good police officer. How should we expand that?
Well, I think we need to seriously look for, you know, recruit and hire people whom we value for their non-overlapping perspectives. And those could be, you know, based on racial diversity, ethnic diversity. It could be people with blue hair periodically. It could be people who just think a little bit outside the box. And one of the problems I see in policing is that you're right, that the police tend, the recruiting paradigm is based on one that screens undesirable candidates out, when in my view, it should be the other way around. It should be based on screening people in to make sure we bring in people who best, exactly what Sonia Pruitt just said, who best represent the communities and who can go into these neighborhoods. They understand the tragedy of having to use coercive force as part of their mandate, but they can put themselves in the life circumstances of the people, you know, they're having to police. And to me, that's the opposite of what police departments shoot for, right? Well, pardon the pun, shoot for right now.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Lawrence Ralph?
Yes, I mean, and I think that we need to think more expansively and recognize that the police aren't the solution to every problem. So how do we endow other institutions with the ability to address these underlying problems? Just quickly, we talked about the recent spike in crime, and I think we have to realize that we are in the midst of, you know, the greatest loss of jobs since the Great Depression in the 1930s. And if crime didn't coincide with that, as Robert said, that would go against all social science, right? And so we would expect an increase in crime in this time of uncertainty, where homelessness is increasing, joblessness is increasing, people's mental health is being strained, drug and alcohol addiction is cropping up again. And the police aren't best equipped to address those problems. And so who in society is best equipped? And we have to give those people the resources in order to address these underlying problems.
And let me pick up on that. Let me first reintroduce everybody, and that is Lawrence Ralph. He's director of the Center on Transnational Policing at Princeton University. Robert Kane is head of the Department of Criminality and Justice at Drexel University. And Sonia Pruitt is head of the National Black Police Association, and we are talking about police reform, what it should and could look like. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Sonia, let me go back to you, but have we expanded the role of police beyond, I guess, what they're actually trained for? I'm thinking of dealing with homelessness or dealing with drugs or sort of mental health issues and problems that certainly can happen in a society, that we're asking the police to do too much. And maybe flipping that on its head is that we have criminalized so many different behaviors. And I'm thinking about police that are in schools, for instance.
Yeah. So I have some mixed feelings about this, but at the base of all that is things that we've already talked about, which is that the police are not equipped to handle all of societal ills, especially since, in my opinion, the police are the law enforcement arm of those societal ills. So I worked for a police department which actually did try to handle some of those issues by outsourcing a bit mental health concerns and issues, and also the school resource officer program, which I think was probably one of the better ones in the country, reimagining how those officers would look, and then also trying to decriminalize homelessness. And so, you know, there are police departments that are doing the work. But right now in this time, I'm thinking, you know, the public is saying, we don't even want you to think about doing that work. And I'm not against that. I think that we have room to take a look at what we are actually doing as the police. And is it efficient? And, you know, talking about defunding, are we spending money in the right places? Mm-hmm. And by the way, for the audience, we do defunding all the time with police departments. That's not anything new. So, you know, just want to be clear about that.
Robert Cain, is it helpful to think of crime as a public health problem besides another kind of problem?
Yes, absolutely. I think the research on this is in the convergence among nursing, public health, and criminology, among other fields, is demonstrating pretty clearly that it's probably best to think of crime as a public health problem. And the police should go, you know, should respond as if they are part of the public health apparatus. And something, I think Sonia just said a second ago, and it seems like Lawrence, it's interesting how there are a few different perspectives going on here. And
yep.
Partly this idea of defunding the police, or at least, you know, shifting resources to more upstream institutions, perhaps, that can better, you know, respond to things like homelessness and addiction and mental illness. But it is important to also think about it in this sense, from a policing standpoint, from this sense. Police are the only institution we have who are deployed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in communities, and they see everybody. They don't just come to your house when you call them. They are out and about. And by the way, most people call the police for non-criminal events, as Sonia could probably, I hope, could sort of support me on. But it seems like the police, they are everywhere. At least they'd like to have you believe they're everywhere. But they are generally out there all the time. So on one hand, they do respond to exigent circumstances, mm-hmm. and they tend to do so pretty well. They're very well trained in the United States. But they're also the canary in the mine. The police can, you know, through their daily deployments of just driving around in a preventive patrol structure, they can actually be the eyes and ears of a neighborhood. And they can come back and they can report back and tell us where they're seeing some of the hotspots of mental health problems, or where they're seeing some of the, you know, the homelessness, or where they're seeing a bunch of needles. And not so much to criminalize those behaviors as much to partner with other agencies that they can work with, so that they can start to respond to these in a more kind of public health mindset.
Lawrence Ralph, picking up on that and going back to this notion of community policing, and even the report that came out of the 21st century policing during the Obama administration, the call was for police to be guardians, not warriors, and that community policing would be working with residents to, quote, co-produce public safety. I've been doing the show long enough that I remember community policing in Philadelphia and efforts to try to deal with some of these quality of life issues, but it seems we're still stuck.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still stuck, and I think when we talk about particularly the communities that need the resources the most, this idea of the police officer as guardian has really broken down, and it's a question of trust and legitimacy in that respect. And so I agree that in the ideal scenario, the police officers would know and trust the community, but many times when you have such a breakdown of trust, when police departments try to instill seemingly harmless programs like, you know, have coffee with the cop, like they did in Chicago,
right,
and, you know, social interventions, those interventions themselves break down because of the lack of trust. And so the question is, how do we regain that sense of public safety?
Well, that's a question to you, Sonia Pruitt. How do we do that?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in, so here I am.
Here you are. Go ahead.
My last position before I retired was as director of community engagement, and I remember clearly one day we were all in a tizzy because our county council wanted to know, what are you all doing in terms of community policing? And I said to the group of executives that I was talking to, so did we ask them what they mean? Because I don't think they mean how many coffee with the cops are we having. Because the reality here is the people that we needed to reach were not going to coffee with a cop.
Right.
And so I felt like my job was to think about what ways we can build that trust and build relationship, thus having trust and legitimacy. And so I was looking for quality rather than quantity, because not only were officers going to coffee with a cop, but they were going without a commitment to the community that they were having coffee with. And then, of course, there was no commitment to the surrounding communities that really needed us to build that relationship. And I'm generalizing there.
Sure.
But that is a deep issue in community policing.
Absolutely. Do you want to speak to that, Robert Cain, about just how to, you know, there is apparently so much mistrust. How do we bridge that? How do we heal that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to take at least a generation. I mean, I think on one hand, you know, the community policing movement, in my view, is somewhat dead at the moment. And part of it is because many police departments, rather than rolling it out as a philosophy that permeates the entire agency, as it was originally supposed to in the late 1980s and into the early 90s, it's really become relegated as a special unit in a police department. So right off the bat, there's still this overall mission of crime fighting and law enforcement that dominates. And then you've got this community policing unit that you might send into one or two neighborhoods. And Sonia can certainly speak to that more than I can as a police professional. But it seems to me that the first thing, if we really want to talk about restoring trust, and, you know, we've got to stop putting so many young Black males against the wall every time they leave their apartment in communities of color. That's, to me, police departments need to ramp down the coercion. If coercion defines the police, coercion doesn't have to define every police citizen encounter. And they need to recognize that a little bit of coercion goes a long way, and too much coercion is disastrous in neighborhoods.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about police reform. And again, that's Robert Cain from Drexel University, Lawrence Ralph from Princeton University. Sonia Pruitt is the chairwoman of the National Black Police Association. We got some open lines. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about police reform, what does serve and protect really mean now, what qualities do we look for in a police officer, how do we identify and deal with these so-called bad apples, and why do we criminalize so many behaviors? Lawrence Ralph, I want to read just a couple of comments and then give you a chance to respond. An email from Zoe who says, as we discuss the role of police unions in limiting reform, do we need to question the status of the Fraternal Order of Police? It's not actually a labor union, but a fraternal organization registered as such with the IRS. An email from Thomas, it seems like any discussion about police reform has to include the need to end the legal doctrine of qualified immunity that protects police from most lawsuits when they violate someone's rights. And a tweet from Dave who says, how do the panelists feel about the feasibility of personal insurance for police like doctors have with malpractice? It seems like we could price bad cops out of employment. Lawrence Ralph, let me give you a chance to respond to that, the idea of police reform and whether the Fraternal Order of Police overprotects the union and, excuse me, its members and has helped to create some of the problems we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think they definitely have helped create a lot of the problems. I mean, we've been talking about some cultural issues and the way that police officers are socialized to think of the community as the enemy. And I think organizations like the Fraternal Order of Police often kind of foment this idea of the community as the enemy, particularly when an officer does an egregious offense, and there's no regard for how the community might feel, and just the bolstering of the officer must have been right in that situation. And I think the rest of the questions kind of address what we do about misconduct and, mm-hmm. and how often wrong it is. I think right now, oftentimes, when we think about misconduct payouts, the taxpayer is ultimately responsible for that. And so in the city of Chicago, there's a budgeted line item for misconduct payouts. And the police departments know that if something were to happen, it's not on, it's not extracting any resources from them, right? And so people don't realize how often that they are actually literally paying for police misconduct, and that's a huge issue.
Should that come out of union dues, for instance?
It should impact the police department in some way, you know, whether insurance or union dues or some or penalizing the departments who it happens to and frequently. We need to rethink of the ways in which those misconduct payouts or settlements are handled.
Robert Kane, and I believe this is more related to Philadelphia, but Internal Affairs dismisses something like 90% of complaints. 75% of dismissed officers are reinstated. Is the union a problem?
I think that unions in policing are troubling across the country, and because it becomes virtually impossible for police chiefs or police commissioners to hold officers fully accountable when they have to fight the union at every step of the way. And in Philadelphia, all you have to do is get onto YouTube and you know, Google the or whatever, YouTube and sort of search for, you know, public displays of misconduct. And you'll see that a lot of police officers in Philadelphia are rehired, they're reinstated. And one big troubling piece of this is that they can jump from one agency to the next, partly because of the lack of data sharing across police organizations.
And just me add that Vice President Mike Pence is meeting with the Fraternal Order of Police today, and there is going to be a Back the Blue rally sometime today in Philadelphia. Let me get Robin to join us, and Robin is calling us from Germantown. And Sonia, I'll give you a chance to respond to her call. Robin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a teacher, so I've always been really frustrated having police in the schools. And I think the verb that we keep using here is policing. And what is, if we substitute that word with something more specific? Do we mean caring? Do we mean protecting? Do we mean avenging? And that we, when we say policing a neighborhood, we get an image, what neighborhood, what that looks like, and to revision policing into something more specific to what we want the police to operate at, or do we want social workers to operate in that area? Do we want schools to work in that area? So I just keep hearing this word policing, and I'm like, that's the problem.
Oh, well, that's so interesting, Robin. I really appreciate the call. And Sonia, let me give you a chance to respond about, I mean, language is important. What we say and what how it's received about what we say. Is policing a problem word?
Yeah, you know, that is an interesting question and one that I probably need more time to mull over. But I would say I would be willing to really think about that, because language is really, really important. And I think that policing in this country, the word has morphed into this monster. And it's the kind of monster that comes from under your bed at night and gives children nightmares. And so if there is, you know, while we are doing this reform work, I suppose that it's part of our responsibility to take a look at the language that we are using so that we can assure people that when we go forward, that this thing we call policing is adequately termed and have people feel comfortable and safe in the presence of police officers.
Lawrence, you want to respond to that at all?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, I try very intentionally to use the word public safety when thinking about how to provide, you know, safety for the communities in general, because this word policing, as the caller said, does have a connotation, and I think Robert mentioned it earlier too, with enforcement. And so you expect action when you're thinking about policing, and often at times that action entails force. And so, you know, we see this in the way that community residents police each other.
So another thing that we can, you know, easily look on YouTube and see is, you know, oftentimes the white residents of a community policing the black bodies that they see in space who they feel don't belong there. And they, you know, ask them about their ID, they ask them why they're there, they ask them for their names. They, in effect, perform the role of the cop. And then when that doesn't work and when someone reacts passionately to that, they call the cop. And so they weaponize force against the person who they feel doesn't belong in that place. And so it's a question of how do we ensure that everyone is safe, even the person who, for no good reason, is suspected of not belonging.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because it's often said, you know, crime rates are actually down compared to, let's say, the 1990s. But in reading some of what you have written and said, Lawrence, is that that might be true for society at large, but it's not necessarily true for people of color.
Right. And it's not particularly true in certain communities. And so we have, you know, pockets of crime, and we have places where crime has, you know, tends to occur. Mm-hmm. And what I am hopeful for in this moment is that people are recognizing the human connectedness of these social issues. And so I think part of it, honestly, might be that we're having this conversation in the midst of a pandemic where we can't help but realize how closely we all are connected as a society. Yeah. But we are beginning to realize that what happens in those parts of communities that we can easily drive past if we have the resources does affect us all. And again, that's part of the, I think, potency of seeing something like the Floyd video, where we witness a horrific act of violence. And, you know, more Americans than ever before are recognizing that that's not right, and recognizing that egregious act of force can impact them as well.
Robert Cain, let me throw something out that you have written, a bold, maybe even controversial idea, the idea of federalizing police forces, taking it out of local control and giving it to the federal government, the Department of the Department of a Public Health Service. Expand on that and tell us what you're suggesting. I'm going to give Sonia a chance to respond. Go ahead, Robert.
Sure. It seems to me that to a large extent, local policing in the United States has been kind of a disaster for us since the 19th century. You know, it started in the South as slave patrols, and in the North, it was controlling the dangerous classes, and that was, you know, poor people, black, brown women. I mean, so to me, it seems like we really want to, you know, break this cycle of scandal and reform and scandal and reform. The best way to professionalize the police is to federalize them, and not under the U.S. Department of Justice, but actually under the U.S. Public Health Service, because then we could really align our crime fighting goals with our public health strategies, recognizing that high crime neighborhoods are also unhealthy neighborhoods. And it would reimagine what the capacity of the police could do for the country, and even more specifically for the U.S. Public Health Service. We could have police out there in neighborhoods, contact tracing. They could be case finding. They could be educating members of the public, you know, and they would also fight crime, but they would be a different institution. I should say that the 10th Amendment has an issue with my proposal.
Oh, but, it does. But
it seems like, to me anyway, there are ways around that.
What do you think, Sonia?
I think that is another interesting idea for me to mull over.
Okay,
you know,
fair enough.
I do this work in several different circles, and I have to tell you that in many of those circles, there is conversation about federalizing the police. I mean, it's not that far-fetched to many, many people, and I can see the benefit of that. There would be consistency. I mean, we're talking about now having this national database of certification or a national database that tells you when an officer has been fired and they can't be hired somewhere else. I mean, that's kind of moving in that direction in small steps. And so I don't think it's really out of the imagination to think about doing something like that.
Except for whatever the 10th Amendment says. Fair enough, Robert Kane.
Yes.
And we don't sadly have time to go into that. Let me read an email from Simon. And Lawrence, I'll put this to you. Simon says, any discussion of police reform in America is wrecked by two issues of race and guns. Police reform in America could take many points from policing in the United Kingdom, in Australia, New Zealand, where most policing isn't done through force and racial profiling as policing happens mostly without guns. How much do you think just de-arming America would help our crime and even police problems? Lawrence?
I think the question is really important. I think that it is really head on when we think about what makes the U.S. exceptional. And, you know, Robert's right in the sense that the safest countries in the world have, something like a federalized system where everything is streamlined and, you can handle training and you can handle accountability in a streamlined fashion. What makes the U.S. unique, or part of what makes the U.S. unique, is its history of racism and the prevalence of guns in society. And so that police departments can really make the argument, similar to what a caller did before, that the police are already always in danger from the moment of the first encounter. And the prevalence of guns in the United States is a huge issue, because even when we think about crime, part of the reason why we have this uptick in shootings in several cities across the nation right now is because when you have these underlying issues and the prevalence of guns, the availability of guns, the way that those violence manifests itself then becomes through shootings. And so we can't think about the problem of policing without thinking also about the problem of guns in society in tandem.
Robert Kane, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think that it would be great if we lived in a society where there weren't so many guns and where we could possibly have a rational discussion about de-arming or disarming the police. But the fact is, we do have a lot of guns in this country. The Second Amendment is not going away. And our gun violence rates are incredibly high compared to other countries that have guns as well. It's just that ours are a little different. We have a lot of handguns in our cities. And so the idea of taking guns away from the police, it's, in my view, and, you know, I'm a critic of police in many ways, but in my view, it's kind of a non-starter until we get the gun violence in this country under control. Even in the UK, by the way, where, you know, your average constable is not armed, every district in the UK has an armed response unit driving around. The public just doesn't realize that. So the UK, policing in England, they can still respond quickly with guns if necessary, because even they recognize that. In Britain, it's not a picnic in terms of the violent crime that the police see.
Well, we could go on, but we can't. Unfortunately, the clock is telling me we're out of time. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Sonia Pruitt, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's head of the National Black Police Association. Robert Kane, head of the Department of Criminality and Justice at Drexel University, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. And Lawrence Ralph, a Princeton University anthropologist, director of the Center on Transnational Policing, thank you for joining us today on the show as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. We've got a bunch of them, and they're for you to listen to at your own leisure time and wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.